Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 7th, 2025, and our friend Richard Wolf and Michael Hudson are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Michael, let's start with you. And we know that there was a meeting between Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin yesterday. Donald Trump is trying to do something, and he said that was positive. The meeting was positive. It seems that Russia is doing some sort of modifications in the conditions that they're proposing to the United States. But the other part of the war, the conflict, is the way that the United States is putting tariffs on, secondary tariffs on other countries in order to bring some sort of pressure on Russia. One of the countries that is so much important, I would argue, for both the United States and Russia is India. And go ahead, you're taking that.
Well, just the other day, Brazil's President Lula said that Trump's policy is divide and conquer to other countries, that he's trying to prevent other countries from having a multilateral response to the U.S. by dealing with other countries, as the tariffs are due today to be announced, on a country-by-country basis. And the response by the rest of the world is going to be like Benjamin Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we're all going to hang separately. So that's basically what's happening. I think that Trump, if anyone had tried to focus or forecast what Trump's behavior is in disrupting world trade and causing chaos for other countries by saying, if you don't boycott Russia and following that China or any other country that we want you to do, we're going to raise tariffs and prevent you from having access to the United States market. Well, this means that it's the 50% tariff that he's imposed on China, on India yesterday, has virtually blocked it from the U.S. market. So what's India going to do? What are other countries going to do? Trump's trying to bring pressure on South Korea, Japan, and the Quad. In Asia, to say you'd better make the Quad part of the U.S. Cold War. And you can see now what the effect has been already of the sanctions that America has been pushing, not only on India, but on Japan and Korea. They've all the first thing that they did in 2022 with the war between Ukraine and Russia, I should say between NATO and Russia, was to withdraw from the Russian automobile market. Kia and the Nissan and the Japanese auto manufacturers followed U.S. orders, withdrew their investments there. China moved in to take their place, especially in electronic vehicles. So China's cleaned up, and it now looks that it's going to be very hard for Japan, Korea, other countries to forget Germany altogether, to regain the Russian market. The question is, having already had these 3 years of losing markets by following the U.S. demand for sanctions, they are deciding that it's a losing game. Well, Trump is going to say, you think that's a losing game? Wait till I impose the tariffs on you if you don't do what I want. And so here's what other countries are faced with. Are they going to lose more money by losing the U.S. market because of the tariffs that block their coming here? Or are they going to look at the longer term and say, well, if the price of holding on to the U.S. market and obeying Trump's demand for low tariffs on us is we lose the China market, the Russian market, the Asian market, the Indian market. Over time, are we going to live in the short term or are we going to look in the long term? That's really the problem that Trump has brought about. And I think that there's other countries are going to decide to live in the long term. And that requires such a huge reorientation of their trade away from the United States, so expensive. It means that a lot of hymns in India and Asia, Malaysia, are going to lose the American market, and a lot of firms will go bankrupt. Well, this is going to be very hard. They're certainly bringing pressure on the government. But the question is the government going to try to say, well, what's the second best solution to the U.S.? If we lose that in the short term, how can we move as quickly as possible to reorient our trade for what we don't export to the United States, to develop a new market, not only in Asia and the existing thriving economies and growing economies in Asia, but how can we help create a system to revive the global South countries that have whose development has been blocked by neocolonialism, the legacy of European colonialism, financial imperialism? How can we rebuild them and create a new market for us to deal with without the United States? That restructuring of world trade is going to be very expensive. It's going to entail short-term losses, to be sure. But because the cost of reorienting this trade, the effort is so great, it's going to be very hard to reverse these decisions and to somehow end up reviving trade with the United States. Once the United States loses this trade as a result of Trump's bullying and shakedown and protection racket to other countries, either you do what we say or we'll cause chaos, I think that you're going to find a reorientation of trade that's going to leave the United States isolated with a sharply rising costs in a shrinking economy of stagflation, stagnation, inflation. That's going to be probably the result if multilateralism and leads other countries to act together instead of letting themselves be divided and conquered.
Yeah. Richard, it seems to me the way that Donald Trump is behaving toward Brazil, that I'm living in, the country that my country and India, it seems, let's punch you in your face and you're going to help me to hurt Russia as well. But before going to that direction, you have to learn a lesson. I have to punish you before going to Russia. What is this sort of, that it doesn't seem to me a strategy to go in that direction, to behave like this.
Well, no, it seems to me it is a strategy that, you know, you can try to get people to do what you want by offering an incentive that is positive, or you can get them to do what you want by threatening to do something that is negative. And Mr. Trump, I think it's fair to say, having tried or seen his predecessors try to do things in a different way, has decided that the way to do this is to bully or to threaten or to whatever you want to call what he's been doing for the last 6 months, you know, a trade war, reciprocal tariffs, higher tariffs, wildly higher tariffs, sanctions, more sanctions. These are all what you might call negative incentives that, as you put it, involve either a punch in the nose or the threat of a punch in the nose unless you behave. And I agree with Michael, I don't think this is going to work much better than the other one didn't seem to work. I infer from such pieces of information that there is something more fundamental going on that is simply not amenable to either the positive or the negative strategic moves. India has very big issues to solve, both internally, because it has many problems, and externally. And it is busy trying to do that in a way that, you know, conforms to Mr. Modi's politics and so on. I don't think the United States' role in that is big enough to make a large difference. And the United States can't handle that fact. That is very troubling. It wants to believe that its very words, look at what the example Michael gave us, its very hints of something could lead a Japanese car maker to take drastic action that they already regret. But they did it. And so there's a basis for the American strategists to think they can do more of this because they can't face the underlying problem, which is that, again, I don't mean to beat the horse, but it has to be said in a country that keeps denying it, that the empire is over. It cannot do what it once did. And it finds it unspeakably outrageous that that is the case. So it either behaves as if it weren't the case, very childish, but understandable, or it overreaches, using Michael's term again, very typical of empires in decline, or it actually tries to threaten and then is surprised to discover it doesn't work. You know, you can see Mr. Trump, unable to get Lula to do what he wants, decides he's going to bring Mr. Bolsonaro back into the political life of Brazil. You know, violating every conceivable notion of appropriate diplomatic behavior. You know, it's just, these are signs to me of desperation. But now here's an economic fact. I was struck reading the financial press this morning by two stories that I think bear on what we're discussing. The first is the report that in the last quarter year, if I have the numbers right, may have been in the last 2 months, Chinese exports have soared. They have achieved a sudden spurt of exports at a time when the United States is hampering them with tariffs, is hampering everybody else with tariffs. What is going on? And the minute you disaggregate the numbers, you see right away their exports to the United States have gone down, but their exports everywhere else have gone up more than American exports to America have gone down. And that is a very important fact, because if the rest of Asia understands what I just said, and they're looking at the same numbers I am, then there's the path. How do you get out of the damage the American threats entail is that you find export markets elsewhere, which is what the Chinese have done. And since a good number of their exports are to other Asian countries, they are incentivizing those countries to begin to work very hard, leading a number of observers to infer that what we're going to see is a bizarre outcome, a deflation in the global south, that as all of this supply that used to go to the United States doesn't, and all of it goes to the rest of the world, you're going to have, at least in the short run, an excess supply and no particular change in demand that we would look at, and therefore a deflationary impulse. And I'd like to talk about it for a moment, because the tariffs, and this was the second story that caught my attention, both Bloomberg and the New York Times this morning carry articles about tariffs showing up in rising prices across the American consumer landscape. All right, now let me put these two together. Inflation in the US, deflation everywhere else. This is very bad for the American future. How are you going to ever persuade people to move production from elsewhere in the world to the United States when the United States is an inflationary core of a deflationary world economy? That's not a recipe that would make any CEO I know move to the United States. It would make them consider seriously not doing that if they had had a plan to do it. So, yes, they will say to Mr. Trump, we planned $400 billion of investment in the United States. Very nice. You plan. And it's going to be over 4 to 10 years. A carefully chosen number because it's after Mr. Trump, to whom the promise was made, is no longer the president. But we are watching adjustments in the world that allow Michael and me no longer to have to say, it likely will be that, because what we were saying, it likely will be that, is now happening. The combination of recessionary indicators, that's what all that kerfuffle was last week about the employment numbers, you know, that got adjusted downward for 2 months and were very bad for the latest month, and Mr. Trump's dramatic firing of the poor woman who had the bad luck to issue the statistics. But those are signs of recession. And the stories in today's press are signs of inflation. That gets you the stagflation with which Michael just closed his comments.
Well, Richard, you begin by explaining the one of the key reasons for the decline in the American empire by the fact that the U.S. is in denial. That's really the key. It's denying the fact that the U.S. is losing its international position. And I think the reason for this denial is pretty clear. If a politician stands up in Congress with today's Yahoo, you know, pro-American propaganda, if a politician says America's the era of American dominance is over, that's going to be considered anti-American, Putin's puppet, a tool of China. They can't come right out and admit that, although the Wall Street Journal today did quote the Council of Foreign Relations as saying, well, the tariffs are not going to make a big enough impact to lead foreign countries to really reinvest here. The problem is that the in denying that the United States has lost its position, they are blocking themselves from explaining why the United States has lost its position. And the result is they're coming up with a kind of junk economics. They're blaming it on other countries weaponizing their foreign trade. That was what's been accused of against Russia since 2022, that somehow Russia was weaponizing its oil and gas exports against Europe. Well, weaponizing means you all of a sudden stop your foreign trade, stop exporting, and you try to starve other countries, saying, you know, we are going to disrupt your economy by not exporting oil and gas or food or fertilizer. Russia never did that. Russia had thought that there was a mutual gain between its exports to Europe European exports to Russia. But what you're seeing now is the U.S. officials indulging in what psychologists call projection. They accuse other countries of doing just what they themselves are doing and using foreign trade as a weapon to destabilize foreign businesses and driving other companies bankrupt if they made long-term plans to export to the U.S. market. And all of a sudden, these plans are disrupted by Trump saying, well, if you don't give us a political political gift by joining our Cold War against Russia and China, then we're going to weaponize our foreign trade and weaponize the dollar, just as we've weaponized as we grabbed Russia's $300 billion. So part of what Trump has done to respond to all of this in denial is to say, maybe there's a workaround. Maybe we can somehow convince other countries to invest in the United States. And his solution is to devalue the dollar and to somehow say, you know, we're going to make the American market more competitive by having a lower dollar. That's going to compensate for the inflation that you've just pointed to, Richard. Somehow the lower dollar will make it even cheaper for other countries to buy factories and reinvest in the United States. But that's all crazy. Trump's idea is that if there's a lower interest rate, then speculators on Wall Street are going to do what they did during quantitative easing. They're going to borrow at a low price from U.S. banks and buy higher yielding bonds and stocks in foreign countries and make an arbitrage gain and buy this carry trade. Speculating against the dollar as interest rates go down, this is going to drive down the exchange rate. And Trump thinks this is going to make exports more competitive. Well, this is sort of a dream that you can only believe if you ignore all of the other things that are happening. And what you've seen in the last 2 days of the U.S. press is soaring American profits for American companies, soaring American stock market prices, because the tariffs that Trump has imposed have created an umbrella for monopoly pricing by the United States. And this is lower interest rates in the United States will make it possible for American firms as well as foreign investors to borrow cheaply and buy American stocks and bonds. And of course, that will bid up the dollar. So they're going to be all, there's no way of that anybody can make a forecast as to which of these tendencies is going to be stronger, because it's chaos. And if you're trying to say, use chaos as a means of creating a world that is somehow going to enable the American empire to do and recover what it was able to do in 1945, when it was setting the whole world's economic rules and also military rules and diplomatic international institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, it can no longer do this. It can use veto power that it has in the IMF, the World Bank, and United Nations to block any progress. And so all the United States can do to support this policy is to prevent, to stop the clock of history from moving forward. Other countries have the choice. Are we going to let America stop the clock? Are we really locked in to America's threat to destabilize us? Are we really going to just surrender like the European Union did? Or are we going to use the European Union surrender and the German deindustrialization as an object lesson, as a warning for what's going to happen to us if we go the U.S. route? And I can't imagine that the governments, even if the present government say, yes, we're going to go the U.S. route because our whole careers have been working for the United States and our personal careers has been like that of Mr. Starmer or Tony Blair as tradition, you know, the whole tradition of foreign leaders following U.S. and NATO policy. Well, even if they try to do this, you're having a nationalistic reaction on the part of voters abroad that you're seeing. And the question is that that governments that throw in their lot with Donald Trump and the United States and accept his bullying, his protection racket, saying, if you don't join our diplomatic demands to isolate yourself from Russia, China, and the growing part of the world, the global majority, then we're going to wreck your economy, then other countries will, other parties are going to develop an alternative, and ultimately they're going to gain power unless there's a total political dictatorship, as you've seen in Romania and other countries that simply don't let an alternative leader be elected, or in Germany, where they're just trying to ban any of a nationalistic party that is not pro-United States on the grounds that it's not democracy, meaning it's not a client dictatorship.
Richard, let me play a clip of Donald Trump talking about the tariffs. His latest comment on tariffs. Here is what he said.
In trillions of dollars, Andrew. If you look at Japan, we're taking in $550 billion. And that's like a signing bonus that a baseball player would get. He would get slightly less no matter how good he is, right? But they give a signing bonus of $1 million or $2 million or $20 million or whatever the hell they give today. It's so out of control. But a signing bonus. So I get a signing bonus from Japan of $550 billion. That's our money. It's our money to invest as we like. European Union, $650 billion. Think of it. And they're going to buy $750 billion worth of our energy. And they're going to do this. And they're going to do that. And by the way, they're going to open up their countries, which they've never done. Japan has never. If you did business in Japan, they would arrest you. You're not allowed to do any business. And now Japan has totally opened up their country. They're even taking our rice, which is something that nobody said was possible. But more importantly, they're taking our cars. They're taking the very beautiful Ford 150, which does very well, and I'm sure will do very well there. And other things that do very well here will also do well there. You'd be surprised at some of the great things we make. But Japan has opened up. All of these. Indonesia's opened up their country. South Korea has opened up their country. But not only opened up, and that's going to be huge business. When you open up South Korea, it's a closed country. And now all of a sudden we're allowed to sell cars into South Korea and trucks and SUVs. I mean, we're really opening it up. Vietnam is opening up their country. You know, these are all closed countries, but the EU was closed. They wouldn't take our agriculture.
Yeah. Richard.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm an economist. I'm used to my colleagues when they are in a difficult position to make things up. Are you still hearing me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
We can hear you, Richard.
All right. When you're in difficulty, you make things up. When I went last to Europe, I listened. I was in France. I listened. And I watched on French TV as one leader after another talked, as Michael just summarized, about all the horrible things Russia did to Europe, and number one. And number two, the enormous danger that Russia represented once again to the rest of Europe. And that they were the great leaders who were holding on to democracy against Russia's authoritarian behavior. And they were holding on to democracy and their alliance with the United States by fighting for Ukraine. This was the story. And when I met with people there, and I said to them, you know, as far as I can read the history of Europe, Russia never invaded the rest of Europe. That never happened. But Europe invaded Russia repeatedly. And every time they did, they were defeated by the Russians. Napoleon tried it. That did not work out well. Kaiser Wilhelm tried it in World War I, and that did not work out well. And Hitler tried it in World War II, and that did not work out well.
Don't forget Sweden.
Don't forget. So, I mean, what are you talking? Where does this come from? And then, yes, we all know, if we paid attention, that it was the great European-American idea to defeat Russia in Ukraine by stopping to buy oil and gas from a country that they depicted as a gas station pretending to be a country. Okay, those sanctions failed. They didn't stop Russia at all. Russia went somewhere else, making it look like if the Russians had weaponized what they were doing, what was the point? They didn't need to do it. It was you would see a massive alienation of Europe undertaken as an act of policy, which could have been easily solved otherwise by selling oil and gas to India and China. And how do we know that? Because that's what they did. There was no need to weaponize to Europe. None. And it might have been a much smarter move than ever at weaponizing to say to Europe, we will not interrupt oil and gas. We will not cripple your economies. But no, so old and so entrenched was the Cold War mentality of the American empire leading a destroyed Europe into the future, that these politicians who literally were born into that situation and have lived their entire political lives in the Cold War, they have now constructed a Putin, which is simply a changed spelling for Stalin. They first demonized Stalin, went way too far with that also, out of an American notion that when you fight an enemy of America, it is God versus the devil and has to be constructed in that way because Americans don't know how to mobilize themselves, apparently, any other way. So if you're now against the new leaders, they have to be demonized too. They demonize Putin. They demonize Xi Jinping. Is childish, and it's the behavior of an empire that has to attribute unspeakable evil to anyone who wants them to think, oh my goodness, the empire isn't there anymore. Look, it is clear to me that the Europeans are now facing a horrific future for themselves. And you know something? Many of them know it. They may not quite say it, or if they do dare say it, they say it in technological terms. My friend, Yanis Varoufakis, explains quite rightly that all the great new technological breakthroughs are coming from the United States or China. Where is Europe? And the answer he gives to the question he poses is, it's nowhere. It can't do it. It can't organize itself. It can't unify. It doesn't have a unified program for immigration, even something you would have thought the Europeans could replicate the Americans in getting at least enough of a consensus to be horrible to immigrants. Instead, half the countries are and the other half aren't. They can't do anything. Their currency, they can't manage. Their trade relationships, they can't manage. Let me leave you with the following thought, which any informed person would have to ask on pain of otherwise being deficient. If the United States can get its way by imposing tariffs on the world now, what will prevent it, as its problems deepen, from doing more of it? It's the old problem. If you do it, if you accommodate these tariffs now, if you really do what you have told Mr. Trump you will do, you are telling every American politician who comes after Mr. Trump, here's the way to solve your problems. Blame the West, the rest of the world. Punish the rest of the world by imposing payments to yourself from the rest of the world. And you don't have to worry about how the rest of the world will respond, because you're the big empire who doesn't care, who doesn't have to worry. They all have to worry about the big U.S. The big U.S. doesn't have to worry about them. The fundamental flaw here is the United States represents 4.5% of the population of this planet. The other 95.5% are not Americans. And you cannot get around that fact, no matter what you do. And that means a policy in which you, a mouse, is assaulting the elephant will get you squashed.
I want to make a comment on that wonderful Trump speech that Nima played. After Trump made those statements, Japan replied to say, wait a minute, that's not what happened at all. That's not the agreement we made. There was supposed to be a statement that 90% was going to be an enormous investment in the United States, but the earnings, the distribution of the earnings, were going to be in proportion to the money that's put up. If we put up 90% of the money, we get 90% of the earnings. If we don't put up 90% of the money, and if Europe, it's a 50-50 between the U.S. and Japan, then all they get is 50%, not 90%. Well, Nima, you begin the show by commenting on WICA, what Trump said about WICA's meeting with Trump. You can never believe Trump's description of a meeting. It's always identical. He comes on television. Before the other countries have a chance to respond, he said, I won. Other countries surrendered totally to what I demanded. I'm so strong that I can get anything I want. They totally surrendered. Then you have the other countries say, wait a minute, where is the written agreement from all this? Where is the small print? Where does all this happen? Richard mentioned quite appropriately, the Japanese agreement to open their automobile market to American cars. Well, I think we've discussed in an earlier show with you, Nima, the fact that Japanese really don't have a market for American cars. Their roads are narrower than the United States. Their parking spaces are narrower. They want right-hand drive, not left-hand steering wheels. There's beginning to be a backlash in Japan, very much like we've seen in Canada and other countries, against buying the U.S. So how on earth are you going to make Japan consumers buy these American cars that are now, okay, tariff-free, but what's going to happen? How are you going to make them buy U.S. genetically modified corn and grain and other soybeans and other agricultural things? All of these agreements on paper that Trump acts as if there's a reality base isn't a reality base at all. That's the whole problem. Regarding the Russian trade, the oil trade with Europe, remember what happened. How was that weaponized? It was weaponized by the United States blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. That was an act of war. What there's been discussion of in the last week is that British intelligence, and with I'm sure America going along, has been planning to sabotage Russian oil tankers. They're having underwater Navy people plant bombs on the hull to explode the tankers and sink them. This is international terrorism. That's really the only kind of war, the asymmetrical war, in which the United States thinks it has an advantage. And there is talk of a false, the British modus operandi is to mount a false flag. Let's sink a Russian oil tanker in the Persian Gulf and stop the oil trade there and say that Russia did it. instead of ourselves. You're dealing with the belief by Trump and by the United States generally, long before Trump, thinking that they can give their false cover story and that other countries are going to believe it. And I don't think other countries are going to be willing to believe their cover story any longer. You can look at, I want to add something to the European giveaway, since we're talking about information technology that Varoufakis brought about. Europe's response was, well, we're not going to be able to develop our own industry until we make the United States companies, foreign affiliates in our countries, pay an income tax. So we're going to have a standardized global tax that all countries have to pay. Part of the agreement that Europe had threatened to reimpose countervailing taxes on the United States was, look, we've already passed this law. This is going to be part of what we're going to do if you really impose make us a sacrificial lamb in the tariffs. We're going to tax American companies there. But after all, if we don't tax American information technology companies, how are we going to have a level playing field with European ability to develop a technology? Well, they never did it. They gave in. They've surrendered. Again, this is an object lesson for other countries to see what to do. And Trump is in effect declared war on other countries. It's an economic war, and economic war is as destructive as military colonialism is an outright military war. It's destructive of the economy, it's destructive of employment, and it's all together just as threatening because it threatens foreign sovereignty. And so the question is, what are other countries going to do? Well, if we're talking about what the response is going to be to all this, which I think is the logical direction in which our discussion should be going, what can they do? Well, they can stop buying American arms, military arms. For one thing, the war in Ukraine has shown that American arms don't work against Russian or Chinese or Iranian modern arms. So that just as American foreign policy is living 50 years in the past, so is American military technology. It's still based on navies, on aircraft carriers, on destroyer ships, and on tanks, not on missiles or on missile defense systems, which don't work. So that's part of it. Ukraine has shown that doesn't work. Foreign countries can begin taxing American mining companies and oil companies and the infrastructure monopolies they bought and say, this is economic rent. We're going to do what Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and the whole 19th century classical economists recommended. We're going to tax economic rent. You can make as many profits as you want. You just have to pay normal profit tax, which are going to be low, but not. We're going to recover the national patrimony, well, especially for the global South countries, especially for Africa, Latin America. This kind of tax can recover their national sovereignty, because that's what we're discussing today is all about. Will other countries be able to assert their national sovereignty independently of America's dictates and fictitious cover story, the junk economics that American foreign policy is based on? There are more radical alternatives. They can stop paying their dollar debts to the United States. They can create alternative international organizations that we've discussed before. A whole world is opening up to them. That I'm sure that they don't need us to help decide. There will be somebody in these countries that are working very rapidly to find an alternative that will rescue their economies.
I if I could add, I think there's also the private sector that we have not discussed, which is going to be taking steps long before the public dares to do it because of the politics of it. And I learned this when I recently visited Canada. Every advertiser in all these countries around the world has a new theme around which to construct their advertising. If they have been hired by a local producer of fill in the blank, whatever it is, you know, washing machines, it doesn't matter. They now have a new theme. Buy the domestic washing machine, my fellow citizen. Otherwise, you're doing the bidding of Donald Trump, whose name is now not positive in every one of these countries. They all feel attacked by him, which basically they have been. They all feel damaged or threatened with damage. And they want to know, what can I do? Every advertiser has figured this out already. I got something you can do. Buy the product that I'm the advertiser for. That will be your way to frustrate Mr. Trump in response to all that he has done to upset or anger or frighten you. This is going to be a staggering example of what is dryly put in the textbooks as a non-tariff protection measure. Very common. These countries will be swept, they already are, by anti-American views, feelings, ideas, true ones, untrue ones, all of it will be mushed together. But the net result will be that what Mr. Trump said in the clip, we've opened them up, he's going to discover, yeah, and now they're closing them down again. Not by act of government, which won't be necessary, but by act of the entire private profit sectors of the economy, in their industrial associations, in their contracts with advertisers. They are going to be doing what their business logic requires. If you lose one market, you go look for another one. You tell your advertiser, use what's important in the public mind, which isn't just sex and all the other modes of selling, but it's also foreign policy when it is as dominant a theme. And let me tell you, it was all over Canadian television. Day after day, what Mr. Carney said to Mr. Trump, what Mr. Trump said about or to Mr. Carney, and so on. That is the public mentality. And by the way, the numbers are already there. Canadian tourism in the United States is drastically down from what it used to be. Places in Florida and elsewhere that normally accommodate floods of Canadian tourists, because Canada's in the north and Florida is southern and warm, all of that, that's hurting the American business. If you wanted to know what the job creation was by what it did with autos, you have to balance that against what it did for tourism and what it did for in all the other ways. And now a final thought that has worried me. I keep explaining, as you know, that a declining empire is leading the United States to try to control the whole rest of the world, with the unwanted but quite logical result that it's really isolating the United States. Just like Mr. Trump does when he says, I'm going with fossil fuels to make my cars and trucks run, and the whole rest of the world is going with the electric cars and trucks, which do a better job for a lower price. And that in the end will cost Americans competitive jobs on a scale we can't even imagine. But now you have to ask the next question. What is it that makes Americans unable to see the self-isolating, self-destructive path they're on? And my answer is Gaza. Because Israel is clearly, as almost everyone except Netanyahu and his circle can see. Yes, it is blasting Lebanon, and it's blasting Gaza, and it's blasting the West Bank, but it is also isolating itself step by step. And yet it is moving. Nothing is too much. It's a terrifying image, but it might help us explain why the same group of people in this country who must deny the decline of the empire here cannot see the dead end of what the Israelis, that part of Israel, is doing, not just, of course, to that part, but to the entire project of Israel and, dare I say it, to the entire position of Jews around the world who are going to be held accountable for what is going on there, even if they were among its fiercest critics. But you're watching a kind of parallel, self-isolating, self-destructive behavior beyond all rationality. Denial is usually the forerunner of even more psychologically perverse attempts to live in the world. We are caught up in that, and we can only hope and speak out, of course, to try to get a recognition before it's literally too late.
Well, you're talking about the emergence of a new international consciousness of independence, Richard. And yeah, I think you're right as to the catalysts of this. If they see the abhorrence to what the United States is backing in the Middle East as it tries to use Israel to act as America's proxy to control, to be America's Ukraine, in controlling all of the Near Eastern oil so that it can weaponize oil trade throughout the world, then this is helping them realize that there has to be an alternative. And time, I think, is on the side of the nations that are being driven out of the U.S. trade and investment orbit. I think it's on their side because Trump's tariff policy and the related domestic policies that he's following are going to spur a price inflation in the United States simultaneously with the U.S. economy slowing down. And the rising U.S. Debt defaults are already occurring. A financial crash is building up. And it's the result of other countries breaking away. And the American investors and the American companies, you've talked about foreign companies in the private sector reacting against the United States as well as governments. Well, what the American companies are going to realize that they have been left isolated, and their international, multinational operations are going to be prone to foreign retaliation just as well. And I think that this financial crash is going to have major consequences politically at home to go hand in hand with the international chaos that Trump has created. So he's not only creating tariff crisis for the world economy, he's laid the seeds for what has to be the U.S. buckling under this break in world trade and finance and monetary policy, just as other countries are suffering. So America's, if the American empire declines, it's trying to bring the whole rest of the world down with it. That's the dynamic that other countries have to cope with.
If I could, Nima, these kinds of conversations, look, Michael and I may be making mistakes. We may be overemphasizing something, missing something, inadequately appreciating yet another tendency. In a rational community, we would have these ideas, which, you know, we didn't develop, which other people that have taught us, helped us to see. Both Michael and I spent a lifetime being professors in American universities and doing the typical jobs that professional economists do. We didn't live on the moon, and we weren't educated on the moon either. We're part of this country, but we appear on a Brazilian podcast that you have the good sense and the hard work to produce, and I'm grateful to you for doing it. But we have to understand we live in a society that has to marginalize the perspectives that Michael articulates in his writing, in his books, in his interviews. I try to do the same, you know, with my arguments in my capacity, you know. But we are kept at a very marginalized corner of what passes. We're not going to have a conversation about the declining empire on Meet the Press. We're not going to have a debate about how what does the BRICS represent? Are the BRICS part of a reorganized global capitalism? Are they a challenge to global capitalism? How do you understand their heterogeneity? You know, they have China, but they have India. They have Cuba, but they have Saudi Arabia. But these are very important questions. BRICS is now an alliance of a majority of the people of this planet. And you barely hear it. You hear a clip occasionally from Mr. Trump mocking the BRICS or threatening the BRICS. The BRICS are unimportant, or the BRICS, if you do anything to the dollar, well, then I'll hit you, the usual, right? That's what we get. But a conversation among people who study this so that the population has a sense of what's going on, no. We are kept in our silos. The mass media tell a story in which none of these questions and none of the perspectives that either Michael or I articulate have any allowed space. That is as rigid a censorship as you could imagine. The only thing worse is if they arrest Michael and me and we are disappeared in the way that, you know, everyone in this country knows might be coming down the pike.
I can see the thought that you must have had re-entering the United States from Canada.
Yep.
Are they going to deport you for having are they going to hassle you?
All I can tell you was when we were sitting in the airport, you know, in those plastic waiting lounges before you get on your airplane, and the chairs are close together so you can hear the conversations of other people waiting to get on the airplane. Half of those conversations were people making jokes about would they be stopped at the border? Would the ICE people come for them and arrest them? Now, sometimes these were done as jokes, but other times they were quite serious.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm married to a psychotherapist and I've learned to appreciate Sigmund Freud, I know that jokes are probably a more reliable indicator of what's worrying people than anything else.
That's right. Thank you so much, Richard and Michael, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima, and thank you for keeping up the good work here.
I love the discussion.
Yeah. See you soon.